one of the things that you'll probably hear is that with pharmacology and the development of new drugs, today's side effect is tomorrow's new drug. So you may, we've seen that with Viagra. Viagra was originally a heart drug.
Right, yes. I was going to say, there's a bunch of examples in history that, you know, that's happened. Yeah. I couldn't think of any, but that's a really famous one, right?
That is extremely famous.
It's like finding gold in the middle of like a desert.
That one and minoxidil, the Rogaine.
Yes.
It was actually also a heart drug. But in some of the people that took it, it grew hair on their palms. And somebody said, wait, I might be able to put that on my
head. He just went like this, and he's like, oh my God.
I've got hair.
You're listening to Bored with Nelly.
Welcome back to another edition of the Bored with Nelly podcast. Today, I'm joined with Dr. Anne Chappelle, who is a toxicology board certified regulatory professional. That's a lot of words. And an expert in chemical evaluation and risk assessment. You might have seen her on a Wired video, which has, I don't know, several million views. Not big flex. Yes. She answered a lot of common questions about poisons, poison control. And you might have also heard her from her own podcast, Adverse Reactions. Thank you so much for being here.
I am really excited to be here, but I must also give some shout out to my Adverse Reactions co-host, Dr. David Faulkner, who is not with me today, but he and I together make up the podcast.
So. Are you guys still doing that, like regularly? I can't remember what the last episode was.
So we've had two seasons come out. Now this podcast is sponsored by the Society of Toxicology, which its mission, it's our professional society, and the mission is to promote the science of toxicology to people who might not know what it is. So we had our first season, which was released last year, and that was the state of toxicology. And then this season, we called it hidden toxicology and talked about places where you might not think you might find toxicology.
But you've had a variety of guests, like scientists from completely unrelated fields, no?
No, they're still
in the field.
Connection. They still have a connection to toxicology. And that's the thing about tox. It's an applied science versus what we would call a basic science. So as an applied science, you tend to have a more practical application of what your science happens to be. Like you could be a mathematician, but maybe you go into engineering. And that's engineering is an applied science.
That's what that degree does, that electrical engineering, that applied science degree.
Exactly.
Which is now just hanging there for decoration.
That works.
But yeah, tell me about, the love for toxicology or where it all started, I guess.
Oh, it all started when I was a wee young thing. I went to the University of Delaware, graduated, had no idea what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I didn't get into graduate school right away. I was a biology major. And I was like, all right, well, my lab partner, he was working down the street at DuPont in their toxicology lab. And so I applied and I got a internship or cooperative type working position. And I worked there for a year. And after a couple of months, my boss took me aside and said, hey, Anne, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? And I was like, I want your job.
And he really?
Said, all right. Yeah. He's like, whatever, this would be great. So I went to, I quit my job after a year. It was only a year position anyway. So I guess I formally resigned and went to the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science in, guess where it is? Philadelphia.
Oh yeah, my God, I knew it.
Yeah. Well, now it's actually part of St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. So I went there and got a PhD in pharmacology and toxicology. And that's how I kind of got started.
That's a common theme I've noticed with biology students is this feeling of what the hell do I do after the degree? So
yeah.
Did you Especially know?
When I
yeah, what did you know?
My mom.
Yeah, right. So what did you know about toxicology before that, before you kind of went, fully into it?
Zip.
Nothing.
Zero. I even had a class in college about toxicology, and it was a lot of lectures, and I didn't really kind of get it until I actually went to work for DuPont and learned what, it's like if you're a physician, you have a pediatrician and a surgeon and a geriatric physician and all that stuff. The same is true with toxicology. So there's all kinds of ways to specialize in toxicology. And the environment I was in an occupational research toxicology, industrial toxicology, as we would call it. So it was looking at how chemicals in the workplace, how chemicals that are manufactured by different companies, you know, how to protect human health and the environment. Because that's what it was for me. It was the perfect marriage of human health, environment, without actually feeling like I was going to needed to go to medical school try and change the world.
I don't know much about this, so maybe this is a really dumb question. What is the difference between toxicology and, let's say, an environmental engineer?
It depends. I mean, again, it's the environmental engineering. Are you working to eliminate things out
like
of
waste, stuff? Sure, or stuff like that?
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, there's a certain part of tox that is a component of environmental tox, and that, you know, you should understand if you're going to be an environmental engineer. We do have environmental toxicologists, wildlife toxicologists. It is important that if you're going to put some kind of pesticide on a field, that you make sure that maybe you kill the critters of concern, but that also that you don't damage the monarch butterflies and maybe the
delicate ecosystems.
Yes. So, you know, understanding wildlife toxicology is really important is more important in certain fields than others.
And is this a career path with a lot of opportunities and all very different paths, I guess? Because when I was younger, I mean, toxicology is not something that's even discussed. And you would think, you know, I would know a lot of the sciences that are, you know, if I went to electrical engineering, I would have a good understanding of applied sciences and stuff like that. But it's not something that most people bring up or talk about or are excited as a career path. How do you even get people excited about it, you know?
Well, they listen to my podcast. They listen to your podcast.
Plug, yes, of course.
No, it is one of those things where it tends to be a little roundabout to get there. People that are toxicologists tend to really like chemistry, biology, biochemistry, you know, like all those kind of core sciences.
Right.
Although I'm a terrible chemist, so I really like that biology side much better than the ask me to draw any structures, really.
Yeah, I hated chemistry too. All those atoms trying to figure out how they
I'm not a big fan.
Not that exciting for me. Let's turn something on. Let's light something on fire. Let's do something cool, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe not that last part. But anyways, so the first job in toxicology, how was that? What were you doing? What is a typical day for you look like?
Well, now or then?
Then, when you first started out.
So when I first started in toxicology, I was in a laboratory, and my job was to try and understand a real world question that was out there. So and it turned into kind of my graduate research is we were looking at how chemicals that you breathe in get deposited in different parts of your body. So rats and mice, they can only breathe through their nose. That's it. So, and they've got really powerful noses and really powerful ways to detoxify all the stuff that they breathe in through their nose. So my job was to try and better understand that. And certain chemicals, where do they get deposited in the nose? How do they interact with those tissues? How do they cause cancer or inflammation? That sort of thing. And we used it to try and understand why there might be differences in the tumor formation that we saw in some of these animal studies versus maybe some of the workers who might have been exposed to some of these chemicals.
So is this like the early days in that field? I guess, what were the standards?
Well, I'm not that old. Are you kidding me?
For people that are just listening, she looks 25, okay? For anyone that's listening.
25 twice. Yeah.
Okay, what's the early days of this field look like? That's what I'm kind of curious about, because we all know about, you know, certain chemicals are dangerous or poisonous now, or what not to inhale, you know, stuff like that. When did that kind of regulation even come about?
Oh, if you really want to go back in time, the first kind of associations between chemical exposure and the development of cancer, that goes all the way back to Victorian times.
Oh, really?
You know, all those chimney sweeps in Mary Poppins and such, they were all covered in soot from head to toe. And a lot of times the kids, they would use kids to do these jobs because they were little and they could fit inside the chimney.
Sure.
So what would happen is that they would get in there and they would be covered from head to toe in all of this chimney soot, which is has a lot of hazardous type stuff in it.
Right.
And these boys and men, because they weren't using girls for this, started to develop testicular cancer. Aha.
Right.
So they ended up learning that, oh, it was through the constant breathing and actually getting this soot all over their private parts that ended up resulting in cancer. So, you know, you could start to see some of these relationships between exposures and outcome. But for something like the chimney sweeps, I mean, it was really intense. They were exposed when they were young and they could see it develop over just, you know, a couple of years.
Right.
Unlike some other things that we've seen in the environment where sometimes it can take 20 or 30 or 40 years of exposure to be able to develop that kind of adverse reaction that you might.
Right. Is this stupid, but like smoking, in the early days of smoking, when like no one really wanted to address how horrendous it was for you, and
exactly
big lobbies were pushing that it, you know, wasn't that bad for you. And then eventually we have people that are doing full-time research and we have the definitive proof, and then change legislature, all that stuff.
Yeah. So part of a toxicology, you can think of it from a point of, you've got this exposure scenario, and then after some time, you have some kind of adverse health effect. And that's where we use people like epidemiologists that kind of tend to look at the health status and the general health of a particular society. And so it's a really important, if you're going to try and look at trends in some of these things, to look at medical records, death records, hospital admissions, all that kind of stuff. And that's a lot of what the CDC does and some other organizations like OSHA and NIOSH, looking at injury rates and incidents of different injuries and such, to start to try and make some of those assumptions or links into saying, okay, you might have this kind of exposure, and what could that turn into?
Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
But on the other hand, you also have, you know, toxicology and pharmacology. It's really just kind of a balance of each other. So toxicology is more the toxic effects of a dose, and pharmacology is more the therapeutic effects of a dose. So
right.
You actually understand that organ system and that whole pathophysiology. When you perturb certain or change certain parts of that system, that's when you end up looking for maybe a therapeutic drug, like a, you know, some kind of cancer, anti-cancer agent, or something else that is going to, you know, have some kind of effect, because you're perturbing that normal system. So understanding some of that basic mechanistic work, the basic biology, the pathophysiology, you know, how things get in your body, what happens to them when they get into your body and out. That's really an important part of it. And so over time, what you really started to see was these, originally it was a lot of chemists and analytical chemists, because they would be making these materials and then they'd need to see how toxic they were so they could know how to work with them. And then that kind of evolved into, you know, bringing other kinds of scientists in as well.
Right.
One of the more recent, within the last, you know, 20 years, we've seen a huge growth in computer modeling. So, you know, you used to be have to say, okay, how did this animal get exposed? Well, now they've got a lot of computational chemists and computational computer scientists and that sort of thing, making these mathematical models of inhalation and what happens when it gets metabolized in the body, and then how does it get out? And using that information to help extrapolate between different, you know, what happens in an animal And then how do you apply that to what happens in humans? Because
that saves you years of time. That's incredible, right?
Nobody cares if rats get cancer, honestly. Right. Nobody cares if mice gets cancer. They care if what happens in those animals happens by a mechanism that is relevant to me or my kid.
Right. You were talking about pharmaceuticals or pharmacology, I believe, but I was kind of curious, the opioid crisis and stuff like that, is that also something that you would have any, or you know, someone in your field would have any involvement in?
Of course. There's a couple of things. You could have something from more of like a forensic toxicology or just even forensics to look at. A lot of these drugs get cut with other drugs.
Right.
I was just reading recently that they were taking, I can't remember it. You have to cut this part out.
Fentanyl?
Cutting it. Oh. It was like a fentanyl, or it was a cocaine, and they were cutting it with some kind of really nasty carcinogen. And
that's right. Like, yeah. I've heard
that's
about
not
that.
A great thing. I mean, you're not supposed to take it anyway. Right. But these are the kinds of things that, you know, you need to understand. How are these drugs being cut and manufactured? The other thing is that we are also, so when you think of pharmacology, you know, the therapeutic use of drugs,
right.
Part of the problem with many of these opiates is that they are so potent. So how do you target, how do you develop a drug that targets your pain, but not the addictive part of it? Can
right.
you design a drug so that it takes away your pain, but doesn't become addictive? Can you develop a drug that maybe is more specific so that not only is it that it really maybe, I don't know, if you've got pain in your knee,
right.
is there a way to develop it and deliver it to your knee?
Without yeah. giving you potentially a euphoric high that you would prolong
right.
and need more
you
of.
Know, exactly.
Right.
So from a pure toxicology standpoint, I mean, every now and then I'll get a request to be like, will you consult on this overdose case? I'm like, no, that's really more of a physician type.
Thing, right, right.
Than really where I am. But just understanding, you know, what are these drugs? What are their targets? And so toxicology can also, you know, like I said, it was like an applied science, but there's
right.
also a huge amount of basic science and basic research that goes into developing a drug or even just generally into the field so that you can use that information and say, okay, how do you, you know, change this a little bit and get a better, more desired effect?
Okay. Well, yeah. When you put
less of the bad stuff.
When you put it that way, it isn't a really interesting field to be in, and it's constantly changing and evolving. So talk to me about the first couple of jobs you've had and kind of what your main focus was or what you were trying to achieve.
Yeah. So the first job I had, like I said, was I was looking at the differences in mouse or rat noses versus human noses.
Right.
To see how those two are different.
Who pays for that? Is that a school project or what is that?
That actually was work that was through a trade association.
Okay.
So a trade association is like a group of industries, I guess you could say it can be industrial, that have the similar interests. So like there is a trade association called the American Chemistry Council, ACC,
okay.
and that is all the manufacturers of chemicals in the U.S., and they kind of leverage their power. I've been involved mostly with trade associations that are science-based. So we don't do advocacy. We don't go before Congress. We don't go before the EPA. We just, all of us are making the same chemical. So we might as well pool our research money.
Sure.
Because it saves animals, it saves resources, and do the work together. So for that particular project where I was hired, that was a group of companies that came together and said, look, we need to understand this about our chemical so that we can protect the workers better and
sure.
really make our case to EPA on how this should be used in the workplace. So that was paid for by that. I finished my degree and then I went to work for a company called ICI, which is Imperial Chemicals Industries. And I spent about 7 years working for companies that made foam, you know,
foam.
Like you take foam, you know, you take
okay.
like, you know, that one component foam stuff where you
yeah,
spray
yeah, yeah.
the cracks and
yeah.
So that is made up of an A side and a B side. You mix them two together and you get a foam. And depending on the A and depending on the B, you either get the soles of your Nikes, or you get the inside of your refrigerator, or you get some kind of seat for your car.
Sure. It's a funny thought. I worked on foam for 7 years, you know, is that how you tell people?
Well, actually, yes. Yeah, I did that for a long time, and then I ended up doing it again. So in that, when I was working in the polyurethane industry, polyurethane foam industry, I worked with a lot of people, and we were very concerned about asthma, because if you are exposed to one of these chemicals, overexposed to one of these chemicals, you can become allergic to it, just like you can become allergic to a dog or a cat or ragweed or whatever, and you could have asthma. Right. So the main focus of a lot of our work was trying to understand how our chemicals may cause asthma, how you become sensitized to the chemical. That's the first part. And then the second part is the how do you identify somebody early? You know, how do we predict how much you could be exposed to in the workplace?
Right.
Really trying to help understand, you know, teach people how to, you know, handle the material correctly. It was a combination of, you know, toxicologists and people that are called industrial hygienists, who actually go out and like measure a lot of that stuff, the air levels and the surface levels in the workplace. So all of that, you know, that's what I did for 7 years. Then I took a little break from that. And then I went back to it for 8. And then, so I spent a lot of time
with foam.
Worrying about foam. Yeah.
What's a big discovery, or what's the biggest discovery you had with, you know, the company or the foam? I don't even know how to propose this question without sounding ridiculous.
It does sound kind of really ridiculous.
Because you worked on it for 7 years, so I'm assuming there was a lot of stuff going on that needed, constant testing. And
yes and no. I mean, a lot of it is taking the existing data and trying to understand it better. One of the biggest problems when you're trying to protect, when you're trying to evaluate the hazards of different chemicals. In my case, I was interested a lot in inhalation, you know, breathing these chemicals.
Right.
So I told you that mice and rats, they can only breathe through their nose. Right. So when you want to expose them to a chemical, you have to make sure that the particles in that atmosphere that you make are small enough to get through the rat nose. So sometimes it can be really, really hard to generate an atmosphere that is consistent enough and small enough to be able to get in the rat nose. So imagine, you know, you have those, like you got a spray gun, right? And you can adjust the tip of it. So you can make it so it's a really fine spray, right? Or you can make it so that's kind of big drops.
Right.
So in the workplace, you're not always exposed to that really, really fine stuff, right? And we have a lot bigger noses, and we can also breathe through our mouth. So it's hard to extrapolate
it does seem like an interesting problem. Yeah, to solve.
Right. So the biggest problem that we faced was trying to work with the regulators to say, hey, we know that if you make this really, really small and dump a lot of it into there, and let the animals breathe a whole lot of it, you're going to get these adverse effects. But in the real world, that's not what happens. So how do we make sure that we're still protecting the worker, but we're not over protecting the worker either? Because the more protections that you have, the more money it is. So you need to make it reasonable. I mean, we saw this with COVID, right?
Right.
The price of masks, the face shields, all that stuff. We found out that was really necessary to prevent, you know, to protect these workers.
Right.
And that's the kind of stuff where we wanted to, you know, we work really hard to make sure that the people have the right gloves, that they have the right protective equipment, and that it's this, what we would say, the inherent toxicity of the substance. So that was the biggest thing that, you know, I think we worked on pretty well over the years. It's just really trying to get an understanding of what happens to the animal and make sure that we're applying that correctly.
There seems to be an interesting battle in that area. Then if you are trying to, you know, protect and make sure the science is valid, the data is, you know, put in a way that's, you know, not compelling to one side or another, not trying to paint a narrative for, let's say,
transparent.
transparent. Sure. You know, did you have a lot of problems with, okay, this company, you know, wants to make X dollars and they're trying to force certain regulations and that kind of stuff? No.
No. The one of the ones, though, I did think was interesting. I worked for a company that made BPA, you know, and everybody's heard of BPA and baby bottles, and it's disturbs your endocrine system and got to go away from BPA. You got to go away from BPA. Okay. So I worked on the panel for industry, and what you're kind of insinuating is that maybe we all sat around and was like, oh, we still have to use this chemical. How do we manipulate this data a little bit?
Right.
But really, it wasn't like we were doing what the FDA and EPA told us to do, and we were producing that kind of data that they needed. The problem was often that you had researchers who, like in academia, who they have to get grants to fund their research, right? So they actually sometimes have to make a big enough case, you know, and be very good about sharing their science. But we had instances where, you know, you would normally you would have to eat BPA, right? It's in can linings, all that stuff. Well, instead of eating it, they would just inject it into the animals. Well, of course you're going to have different findings if you inject it directly into the rat scrotum. I mean, seriously, you're going to have a problem.
Right.
It's a little different. So it's this balance of we're trying to do the best science that we can, but sometimes these methods, these newer methods, it takes a long time to get them validated so that you can use them. And the other thing was that there was a lot of companies that wanted BPA to be highly regulated because they had an alternative.
Right. That makes sense.
So, you know, it's funny because you'd see that there's BPA free. Well, of course it's BPA free because this is made out of stainless steel. You can't have BPA, you know?
Right. So it's like calling water vegan or something.
Yeah, exactly. So I really didn't like the fact that, you know, that I always found my colleagues to be highly, highly reputable and very high standards. And we were very transparent with our data, as transparent as we could be. But the, just this insinuation sometimes from maybe some of the NGO groups, the non-government organizations, or some of the people in academia, which are like, you know, you guys are all bad. We're not big tobacco. You know, I think a lot of people, they learned their lesson with tobacco that, and they became scared of that. And I get that.
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of weird stuff in history with companies and pharmaceuticals. So I don't really fault anyone for having, you know, assumptions based on what they've heard, because you hear a lot of stuff as you get older. And yeah, like,
and it's the hardest too, is that where do you go for good information?
Right. It's, I mean, not clear anymore.
You Google something, or you do an edge search for something, and you get 15 sites that look somewhat credible.
Right.
And then how are you supposed to discriminate between what's good information, what's bad information? That's really the anti-vaccination movement.
Sure.
They were so good about putting out information about this one particular case and bias with that one particular case.
Right.
And then that kind of propelled itself through the internet. And again, you don't know where to look for information.
I mean, think about the first part of that. What you said is you go through Google. Right off the bat, you're going through one entity. That itself is a scary notion, considering 100 years ago, you know, there was papers and different people took. I mean, you had no access to information, but at least you had, I don't know, different forms of information. I don't know. It's an impossible problem right now, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, I remember early in my career, I would hang out in the library at DuPont, and I would see these journals come through, and I'd read through the table of contents.
Right.
Nobody has paper journals anymore, really. You have it all electronically.
Right.
So the fact that you have more access to information sometimes is good, but sometimes it's not so good either. There's a number of what they call predatory journals.
Sure.
So they do not have very good peer review. And they're putting information out that isn't as rigorous as maybe some of, like, a journal like Nature or Science or something. So, and that's a real problem for, you know, trying to establish yourself. You want to publish.
Right.
And that was one of the things I always knew I didn't want to be in academia, because I didn't want to ever have to fight for grant money.
Right.
I really wanted to, even though that sometimes that meant that where I worked told me what I needed to work on, but still I didn't have to fight for, you know, five other excellent scientists to say, my research is more important than yours.
Right. And you were in that Wired video talking about, you know, poison control. Did you work like on a phone poison control, or is this just because you have the knowledge in the space and you just have
you're
a big encyclopedia of toxicology?
Well, I mean, they did give me some of those questions in advance. So
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, so if I have questions and you didn't prepare for them, gonna have to do some editing is what you're saying.
It depends on the question.
No, I would never.
The problem with poison control is sometimes they're only as good as what you tell them or what happens to be on the label.
Right.
So that tends to be a problem, because I don't think that there's huge transparency in some household product labeling.
Right.
And so that can be a problem, but you do what you do.
Fair. I don't have those kinds of questions that I put you on the spot with. I do have some kind of bigger, interesting topics that I guess we could discuss that I've always been kind of curious. Maybe you don't know about them, but maybe it can just be a general conversation. It's fine. The peanut problem and allergies in general, skyrocketing in many Western nations. Any idea as to why this might be happening?
Well, that's one of those golden questions and, silver bullet. And, if I could answer that question,
right,
I would be a multi-gajillionaire. I think about this a lot with asthma.
Right.
And so part of it is it that we are becoming more aware of some of these things, or is it really coming back to some kind of change in our exposure patterns and the general physiology?
Or a combination of both, right?
On the Adverse Reactions podcast, we talked with a woman, Christina Chambers, and she works on a monkey sanctuary in California.
Cool.
And about 20 years, maybe 15, 20 years ago, and they do a lot of government-sponsored research and such on these animals, but they have outdoor areas for the monkeys to live. And so they ended up having all of these wildfires. And all of these young monkeys were exposed to wildfire smoke. And we followed these groups of animals over time, and found that the damage that happened in their lungs when they were young, that carried through, and they had much more respiratory problems as they grew up versus the adults that were exposed to the same, their mom and baby did not have the same kind of issues. So I think that there's a lot of these kinds of questions we ask about allergies and sensitivity to certain things. I think a lot of it has to do with timing and the shift we've seen in how people are exposed to these things from an evolutionary standpoint.
Right.
So I don't know exactly the answer. I can tell you my sister at like 42 suddenly became allergic to peanuts. So
42.
Yeah. So
that seems highly rare, highly unlikely.
You would think, yeah. So, I became allergic to, of all things, honeydew, in my 30s.
Right.
I have no idea why, but the correlation between when someone is exposed and how that might affect that particular organ as it continues to mature into adulthood, and how that might change your reaction, how you respond to certain environmental stimuli.
Right.
That is something that's so hard. There's so many different factors to consider, your home life, the stress you have, what kind of bedding you might have, or if you have a cat or not.
It's like finding a needle in a haystack to get the answer, right?
Yeah. And it's very easy to make certain correlations and say, eggs are good for you. And then 3 years later, nope, we looked at something else. Eggs are not good for you. And so,
right. Or these radicals that want to go, I'm just going to eat meat for 20 years and let's, yeah. You know, that's going to be great.
God bless you.
Yeah.
You
know? Good luck. I think I was watching a Rotten episode on Netflix, and that episode really stuck out to me. It was really interesting because at one point they were talking about Israel, who had a significantly lower amount of peanut allergies. And one of the ideas that the reason it could be that is because they have this children's snack that has this low dosage of peanuts in it. Mm-hmm. And at a young age, I was originally from Serbia, even I had something very similar. And a lot of kids eat that at the beginning, so they expose themselves potentially at an early age, and then later on, if they do develop it, it's very minor or, you know, not severe, right. or deadly. So it's an interesting field with a lot of, like, I feel like there's a lot of money in it in the future, especially as we...
Especially because something like asthma, if we're talking like just general allergies and stuff, right. Not like the anaphylactic stuff, the symptoms are all the same. Essentially, it's not like my asthma is going to be really different from your asthma. You know, we're going to have airway constriction. We're going to have some influx of immune cells in there. You're going to have changes in your mucus and stuff. So it's just that stimulant, you know, what you're allergic to might be a little bit different. So that understanding that pathophysiology, like what happens when you get a particle inside, how does it get absorbed? How does it interact with your normal immune system, you know, and how can you maybe perturb that a little bit, you know, in terms of maybe some of the drugs or how that they expose it. I mean, they actually do a lot of things to try and increase for certain drugs, how easy they are to get into your body for, because they're trying to find new routes of exposure. So for you. So, I mean, it's not always a negative thing to think about. I'm absorbing something. This chemical is easier to absorb into my lungs than this chemical.
Right.
Sometimes that can be very positive in terms of trying to get a desired effect or get something like insulin, which if you eat it, your stomach breaks it down. So that's why they have to inject it. Is there another way they can get insulin regularly, reliably into your body that maybe doesn't rely upon some kind of intravenous injection.
Right.
So that's the kind of stuff where you might be able to utilize toxicology in your drug development process to say, all right, and there also the unsung heroes are these things called medicinal chemists, because they're the ones that'll take, you know, this cracker and then they will just change some kind of OH group or add something over here and it turns into, I don't know, a club cracker, and so makes it even better. So
playing God, but in a good way.
Yeah, exactly.
A couple months ago, I had an interview with a company that is trying to bring back the woolly mammoth. I don't know what I walked into. Yeah, and they were looking for someone to make content for them, and I'm like, this sounds like the beginning of a really bad movie, and I don't want to be on this end of this battle when you guys screw up something.
Yeah. You know, we all talk about, or you might hear the term GMO and genetically modified organisms and such. And my stuff is non-GMO. Well, in a way, we're all kind of GMO. If you think about genetics and breeding, I mean, technically GMO is taking a splice of a gene that doesn't really belong in a, you know, I don't know, in a cow, into a cow, you know? But when we think about selective breeding and kind of trying to, you know, everybody who has like the pug dogs or the labradoodles, you know, there are certain genetic modifications that you really try to breed for that provide a certain advantage or a certain benefit. And, you know, those kinds of things, we don't always think of those as genetically modified, but...
There's a negative connotation with GMO always, but it seems like as we grow as a population, there's no other alternative to survival. We need to figure out a way to make food and lots of it and stuff like that, right?
Right. And so exactly, trying to make sure that you have some sort of, it's all that unintended consequences.
Right. Trying to remove the bad, keep the good.
Right. You know, we see that sometimes with, like where I live in Pennsylvania, we've had a huge problem with the spotted lanternfly. It likes to eat all kinds of fruit trees and such. It's an invasive species from Asia. The problem is they're like, how do we combat it? Do you bring in a predator for the spotted lantern fly and then cause a whole nother series of problems? So within the science of toxicology and, you know, drug development, all those kinds of things, we really try to look at what those consequences are the best we can. And when you've got these larger and larger cohorts of people, you know, you've got some kind of phase one trial, phase two trial, where you've got some really sick individuals, and this is kind of their last hope, and you give them this medicine, and sometimes it makes them better, and sometimes it doesn't help at all. As you develop the information on that, and you get more and more patient data, and you look at more and more endpoints,
right,
you might find something that is not an intended effect. But, you know, it's just, part of it's just a numbers game, the more and more people that you have. Your goal is really to try and understand that mechanism well enough to predict what those target adverse reactions are and the ones in the tissues that are unintended kind of consequences, you know, because nobody wants to come back and say, you know, I've got this great drug, but, you know, after, you know, we've got a certain percentage that will cause a brain bleed.
Right.
Well, is that brain bleed because of the medicine, or is that something in their particular genetics that makes them more susceptible? So, you know, you open one door and then you crawl through it, and then there's another door and there's a window.
Right.
But one of the things that you'll probably hear is that with pharmacology and the development of new drugs, today's side effect is tomorrow's new drug. So
right.
You may, that's, we've seen that with Viagra. Viagra was originally a heart drug.
Right, yes. I was going to say, there's a bunch of examples in history that, you know, that's happened.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of any, but that's a really famous one, right?
That is extremely famous.
It's like finding gold
one,
in the middle of like a desert.
Yeah, that one and minoxidil, the Rogaine.
Yes.
It was actually also a heart drug, but in some of the people that took it, it grew hair on their palms. And somebody said, wait, I might be able to put that on my
head. He just
head.
Went like this and he's like, oh my God.
I've got hair. So again, you know, trying to,
if
you understand the physiology and how that drug or that chemical, because drugs are chemical, or chemicals are all drugs. Drugs are just chemicals. So understanding how all that fits together and perturbs whatever part of the environment or your biological systems. I mean, it is kind of, you know, if you're curious, if you like science, if you like biology, you know, there are lots of different kinds of jobs that you can get. That maybe play to your particular strengths.
And there's so much to discover there. That's the beauty of it. It's kind of like you're in Indiana Jones, but discovering new sciences and new effects.
Yeah. I don't have a hat and I don't have a whip. So, you know, sorry.
Fair enough.
Guys,
we were speaking of chemicals, and this is something that I kind of heard a lot about in the news many years ago, and then it kind of disappeared. I don't know how much you know about it. These are just kind of fun topics I was hoping to discuss. Something called devil's breath. Was very popular in South America. Have you heard
what
of
was
this?
It?
So essentially what it would do is you would take a small amount of it and blow it into someone's face, and they would become almost like a zombie-esque state where they would be much more open to commands. And there's stories of people, you know, being in the club, they meet some lady, she has some on her hand, whatever, she blows in his face. Next thing you know, he's at the ATM cashing out.
It's kind of like a roofie.
Kind of, is that kind of similar then? But this is much more deadlier because you don't have to inject it. You just have to breathe it in.
Well, I mean, it is true that there are, just for this, I actually just recorded another Wired session, which should be out in a month or so.
Awesome.
And we were talking about those kinds of things, like what goes on a poison dart.
Yes.
You know, and how do you get those kinds of poisons?
Yes.
So there is I think that was called like a devil doer, or another one like that. And you could be actually walking through a patch of this and enough would get on your skin that you could actually start to have some of these adverse effects. It all depends on how much the, whatever it is water soluble or lipid soluble. So what I mean by that is that, you know, when you sometimes have a hand lotion, you know, you put it on and sometimes it feels just like kind of greasy and doesn't really absorb very well. you know, and then you have other ones that you can put on and you're like, oh, that really nourished my skin.
Right.
So it's all about how well that gets into your, through the layers of your skin. Your skin is an excellent barrier for a lot of materials, but not everything.
Sure.
Again, some things you can put on your skin, like nicotine, those transdermal patches with nicotine, you know, those are examples. So it is not unsurprising necessarily that you could get some of these agents that you would grind up these leaves and then, you know, put it in some kind of liquid and try and extract out whatever that is and, you know, make it into some kind of inhalable agent. You know, again,
you know, it's a weapon, realistically. It's a scary thing. Speaking of that kind of stuff, another thing that I kind of, so you haven't heard too much about devil's breath. That's going to be a good rabbit hole.
Not specifically, but those kinds of, you know, really, those agents that really affect the CNS, like that, the central nervous system. You know, there's a ton of them out there from, that have been used historically for poisonings, for, you know, again, for, medicinal purposes, for anesthetic, because, you know, maybe you don't want to remember that you had your leg sawed off, you know, out there in the Middle Ages kind of thing.
Right. There was another one that I kind of, you always hear in movies, sometimes in the news, chemicals that you put on like doors and they have lethal effects if you touch it.
Right. So there is a chemical, there, one of the ones that you could think about would be dioxin. There was some very famous poisonings of dioxin. And even most recently with the brother of Kim Jong-il, he had killed or something.
Right.
Where again, that's what they did is they just touched him with the stuff and it was absorbed in. So there's certain mercury compounds that can happen with, where you can get exposed and within a few days it damages your liver to the point where you have multiple organ failure. Wow. You know, those are not unreal. The Soviets have these Nikovesh. There's a certain kind of series of nerve poisons that the Russians developed, and that was that Nikovi. There was a guy that was recently, in the last couple of years, poisoned with that. But yes, some of these are very, very toxic and can get absorbed through the skin. Or you put them with another agent like lidocaine. You've heard of, you know, lidocaine, lidocaine pain patches.
Yes.
Lidocaine's really good at getting through the skin. And so what you can do is you can take that and put it, mix it with an agent that maybe doesn't get through the skin as well. And that kind of helps them both get through. So, you know, using and mixing those kinds of things together can enhance some of the absorption capabilities of these different substances.
I always find it interesting when, you know, company, media, whatever, someone says this country or this group, whatever it might be, made this thing. And then in my mind, I always think, well, if they have that capability, what's to say every country on the, like, are they really that far ahead in their research in terms of this poisonous, you know, let's say door touching chemical? And are we really naive enough to think that, you know, our own governments wouldn't have found ways to do this as well? Not just for, you know, malicious intent, but just for protection and other things, right?
I'm sure that there's that kind of things that goes on. There are federal research agencies that that do look at chemical weapons. And so they're also interested in if my soldier gets exposed to sarin or mustard gas, how do I help them in the field? So in that case, maybe you have to do some research with mustard gas or sarin very carefully, of course, extremely, extremely carefully, in different animal species to look at potential anecdotes. No, not little stories. Antidotes.
That's a good
good catch there. But those are the kinds of things that, you know, those are real. There was a book maybe 20 years ago called The Hot Zone, which they also made into a movie about a monkey research facility in the DC area. And one of the monkeys had Ebola.
Oh, yes. I've heard about this.
And as it turns out, it was Ebola that didn't get transferred to humans. Like, it didn't make the humans sick. But it was this whole thing. I mean, this research facility is like right next to a daycare. You know, it was crazy. But, you know, the jumping of jumping of viruses and such from between different species can be very, very difficult, as we've seen with SARS and the swine flu and bird flu and such. And, you know, this is, you know, what we've seen with this global pandemic. It's not, you know, it's surprising that it took this long, actually, for it to actually happen and shut everybody down.
Right. It's fascinating that your field can go into, let's say, the highly classified areas of potentially governments, and there is a lot of malicious ways to use your knowledge, obviously, in the wrong hands.
So don't give out my address, you know, kidnapped.
You guys can't see the video, but there's a bunch of weird chemicals in the back. I don't know what she's making.
I've got everything distilling in the background. Yeah.
Fair enough. So, and that's
one of the great things about toxicology is that you can open up a newspaper and find something about related to toxicology every day, whether it's environmental justice, you know, when you're talking about all of these populations of minorities that live near these chemical plants, they're going to be, because they can't, there's no other place, you know, that's where they live, and they're economically oppressed, and they're going to have higher exposures to these chemicals because they live right next to the plant. Even things like lead paint, you know, you live underneath a bridge, they're painting the bridge. It was used to be lead paint on the bridge. You're going to get exposure. So,
or those, you know, miners that led to the opioid crisis, a lot of them taking.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's so
all
many
of these things with climate change, with, you know, environmental justice issues. You've got issues around just even availability of drugs for people, you know, the overprescribing or underprescribing of certain things. You know, they were tracking COVID rates by looking at wastewater and the wastewater treatment plants to look at the viral load in there. So there's all kinds of ways, again, that toxicology can really, you know, help to improve, you know, improve general lives. But at the very core of what I'm interested in is around occupational safety. Like, I'm really, you know, where I work now for SafeBridge Regulatory and Life Science Consulting. Thank you for letting me do this interview today. We do a lot with occupational exposures and considering that in the pharma industry, because that is great. If you are there and you're making Lipitor pills, which should lower your cholesterol, you're making Lipitor pills for people, but your lipid levels should not go down if you work at that facility because you weren't prescribed Lipitor. So we want to make sure that all of the nurses and doctors that administer chemotherapy agents in hospitals, they're exposed to some really nasty stuff. We want to make sure that they are being handled correctly. We want to make sure all the different drug companies and the, you know, the packagers and the pill makers and all that kind of stuff, they're handling sometimes some very, very potent compounds. We want to make sure that they are all protected. So for me, it's kind of just everywhere that you everywhere you would touch a drug or a chemical.
It's a fascinating field with so many options, and it's never going to go away. I mean, it seems like,
I don't think so.
It's one of those.
And today's, there's so much regulatory control right now too in Europe. Yeah.
It's not going to lower. It's only going to go up. So
you have this new regulatory initiative. I'm employed for the next 10 years. Thank you.
Well, we're drawing towards the end. I mean, tell me a little bit about what you're doing now, what you're most excited about.
So I kind of hinted at it a few minutes ago, but my current role is working with different, in consulting, working with different, what we call drug innovators, and trying to make sure that they have, because you may be developing this new drug. You don't know anything about it, really. Maybe you know what the mechanism of action might be. Well, that doesn't tell you how well you need to control that substance in the workplace. Do you need to put it in some kind of fancy hood with, you know, the glove arms going in and, you know, doing
like
all
that
stuff?
Like Chernobyl or something.
Yeah. Or can you just work with it on the benchtop? Those kinds of things. So taking data, a lot of times a very limited data set, and trying to extract, you, not trying to, but I extrapolate that information towards, so that we can come up with a way to make sure that those workers are safe. Okay. And also the same, like if you're making a batch of some kind of nasty chemical or nasty active pharmaceutical ingredient, you finish making that in a batch and then you wash it out the tank. And then maybe you're going to make aspirin in the next batch. You want to make sure you don't carry over any of that stuff. So a lot of that kind of stuff now, really helping people helping all these different companies to make sure that they have thought about their workers and how to handle these substances correctly.
And on top of that, you're doing obviously a lot of this kind of, you know, podcasting content. Are you also enjoying that side of, you know, being able to talk openly about everything you're doing with random people on the internet?
I'm very shy, so that worked. One of the other things that I've been working a lot on recently is about science communication. You know, how do we become better scientists in communicating our results to either our peers or the general public?
Sure.
You know, I think a lot of people have this perception that, you know, scientists wear a lab coat and then they, you know, they can't talk to anybody and they just write in their little lab notebook and, you know, that's not most of the people that I know. Okay, well, it's a lot of the people I know. But then you also have people like me who it's really important, I think, to translate what you do into something other people care about. And I do like making people excited about science. My friend's daughter was going to go to graduate school for chemistry. And I was like, don't do that. Go for toxicology. You can focus in on analytical chemistry within the field of toxicology to have a practical application of your degree when you get out.
Right. That's invaluable. Those kinds of conversations with the younger generation to figure out where they want to go in life. That's kind of the biggest goal I'm trying to do, I guess, with the podcast in some sense. So yeah. We did have almost an hour podcast. Anything you want to promote? Obviously, I'll leave your podcast down in the description.
I think that there are some of these professional organizations that are really good out there. I work with the Society of Toxicology. That's where I'm a member of, and they do a lot of good work in terms of promoting science and transparency in science. I also really like to, just encourage people to, if you have a scientist is not always right, unless right. I'm talking to my husband, then I'm always right. But the process of science is that you ask a question, you get some data, you draw some conclusions, and then you get more data. And you may need to change your conclusions based upon your new data. And I want the public to know that that doesn't mean you're a bad scientist. That means that you are listening to the data, that we've heard so much over the last couple of years that the science was wrong. They didn't know what they were talking about. They were gathering data and making decisions with the data they had at the time. It's really easy to look back and say, oh, they should have done X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
So I encourage the public to go to reputable sources if you have questions, to, to trust the system to a certain extent and just ask questions until you get some answers that really kind of resonate and make sense.
Most of these systems are not built on, don't have malicious intent. Maybe certain individuals within a system, yes, but on a general, most of these people that are working on this stuff are not your, billion-dollar people that want to change the world. These are just normal people like you and I that are trying their best in their very difficult, probably stressful jobs.
Yeah. And, I can't imagine, I've never worked for a drug company. I can't imagine how exciting it must be to get your drug on the market.
Sure.
And really see you be able to prolong someone's life in a very positive way, or be able to recommend a drug treatment that gives a quality of life, or, those kinds of things that, even if it is just somebody taking an antacid, and now this means they can go out with their friends and do
right.
So the power of that, to change for the good, some of these things. I also have to throw a shout out, I guess, to the Obama Foundation and the Clinton Foundation and the Bill Gates Foundation. They are doing so much with these conditions and developing drugs where they're not going to make any money, but the kinds of change that they will have and the impact in some of these countries to control diarrhea, to rehydrate, those really will change the lives of millions and millions of people right. in a way that us in the developed world will never really have to worry about.
Great way to end it. Thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed this.
This was great. So we just have to figure out now how to make your degree applicable to toxicology.
Yeah, well, I think that ship sailed, unfortunately, but you know, you never know. Maybe it's a second calling.